Welcome back to Dairy Public Radio, a bi-weekly Stephen King Book Club podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Joshua Kahn, and today I am flying solo for an interview I have been waiting a year to do. I'm so hyped. I am here with Colleen Duvall, Mark Eugene Garcia, and Andy Abrams, the creators of the king-size parody Shining in Misery. Welcome to Dairy Public Radio.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So first of all, we have a few standard questions every guest has to answer, or else suffer the consequences. You know, these are a big deal, folks. First, I'd like to know, what was all of your introduction to Stephen King?
Who wants to start?
she's our king expert.
Nice. Here.
My mom recommended I read The Shining at age 12. And I got a used bookstore and I never looked back.
Outstanding. 12 for The Shining. That's...
Yeah, and I reread this one at least 10 times, probably two of which while we were writing the book for the musical. So
amazing.
Yeah, I have two. I mean, I first did it Through the Eyes of the Dragon, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, a friend recommended that to me in middle school, and I remember reading it and loving it. But unwillingly, I was a kid and I was flipping through channels on TV, and I saw a show where a little kid like had powers, and I was like, "Oh, this sounds fun." And I'm watching this kid talk to another guy through his mind, and I'm like, totally, I'm thinking it's like Escape to Witch Mountain. I'm having a blast. And then it takes this dark turn as it, yes, it was The Shining on TV that I stumbled onto as a child.
Oh, boy.
I probably came to Stephen King the latest of anybody, although Colleen and I went to high school together, so... she made me watch The Shining, which I liked very much. And then I saw Stand By Me in the movie theater when it came out, mm-hmm. and I loved it. And I realized later that wasn't your typical Stephen King story. And it wasn't until I got older that I started really like realizing how much I loved the horror aspect of what he does.
Yeah. It's so crazy the amount of people, like, I love that in this, we got a Stand By Me and Eyes of the Dragon, two very genre different that most people think of. Do you have any Stephen King moment? That's what we call them on our show. They're moments that live rent-free in your head. When you think Stephen King, you think this moment from a book or a movie.
I'll start because mine's really stupid. So I think of... This is terrible. I think of the little Pac-Man chompy langoliers.
Yes!
From the TV movie.
Awesome.
Which I loved, but which was terrible. And all I can see in my head is the across the airport. That's all I see in my head when I... And I like Stephen King more than that, but...
My dad was furious because he watched that entire thing waiting to see what the langoliers looked like, and he kept telling me, "I want to see this. I can't wait for them to get there." I remember watching this with him, and then that happened. He looked at me just dumbfounded.
Space meatballs. Yes. The problem.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, there are so many that stick in my head, but probably a weird one that not a lot of people would think of, and this kind of harkens to Andy Abrams mentioning the movie Stand By Me. A lot of people, I don't think, realize Stephen King has a great twisted sense of humor, and that whole sequence of the story of Lardass and everybody throwing up berry pie. Yeah. Stop laughing. It was just so gross. It's so funny. And yeah, I get a kick out of his weird side like that.
I think for me it's dark, but it's when in Pet Sematary, when he walks out, when the little boy walks out into the road and you know what's gonna happen. Mostly because that's one of the first times I ever felt like I was watching something where I realized nobody was safe. Ooh, and all of his work is like that. Like there is no just, oh, this person's gonna make it. they have to work to make it. And that was a moment where I realized, okay, if he's gonna go here, then we're in for some good storytelling.
Now, you all pass. You're allowed to continue your journey to the tower. So congratulations.
Yay!
Let's talk about the reason we're all here today, to celebrate Shining in Misery. Could someone please tell us, what is Shining in Misery?
Colleen?
I would call it a true musical parody and comprehensive tribute and celebration to Stephen King and his amazing body of work.
That is 100% something I agree with after having seen it myself. What brought this idea out?
Well, it was basically Andy Abrams started out by approaching me in the summer of 2019. And we'd kept in touch over the years, and we'd always meant to collaborate on something together. Hadn't gotten around to it since high school. but yeah, someone beat us to the punch on an Edgar Allan Poe opera, so that was out.
Well, but actually, I have to jump in here and say that there, and I'm not going to name this musical because I don't want to say anything negative about it, but I had just been working on it on a horror musical directing a horror musical somewhere, and it had struck me. I was like, this isn't very good. I was like, why has no one ever done a Stephen King comic parody musical, and we could write better stuff? And so I called Colleen, the person I know who is a Stephen King expert, and said, what do you think? Could we piece this together in some crazy way? And then Mark and I had done a song. We sort of knew each other in New York, but we had done a song together for a mutual friend of ours for a musical that he just had off Broadway called Waiting in the Wings. And we really like working together. And I thought that he had the humor, the right kind of humor to make this work. So then I went to him and said, would you like to do this? And then that started the whole.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a neat process of all of us kind of picking up where the other left off and continuing that, because we all have come with different aspects of it. And so it's been really neat to, like, you know, finish each other's sentences with these guys.
Right. Oh.
So how long have you all been working together now, collaborating?
5 years. Almost five, four and a half.
Oh, my God.
The pandemic did rob us of some time, to be
honest. Yeah, I mean, yeah. for those unfamiliar with the complexities of musical, could you each explain your role overall and what that is in musical theater to bring Shining in Misery to life?
Yeah, well, in this one, I did the lyrics for the songs and then collaborated with Colleen on the script, on the book, the libretto.
I came in to Mark's lyrics and set them to music. And we talk about what is the style, what music seems to make the most sense here, what are we making fun of with the music as well as the lyric, and then we go from there.
For me, this has been a wonderful adventure because this is my very first musical. I've written a lot of theater and screenplays. Nice. This has been a wonderful creative learning experience. for me, it was just, you know, my main thing was when we were talking about mashups, I just really wanted to see Jack Torrance and Annie Wilkes go toe-to-toe.
Yes. So,
starting point, two of King's most iconic, crazy characters. And so much of it, I think, really evolved as we've been creating and fine-tuning those characters and going back and you know, fine-tuning their arcs and their wants and what's going to happen to them. So it's really been a lovely process.
It's also funny too, Joshua, because Mark and I have both done this thing called the BMI Musical Theater Writing Workshop in New York. I did it before Mark, but we come from that world of structure. I mean, Mark, okay. You echo that.
Yes.
They're very structure focused.
100%.
And they're like, I think that helps because it helps us structure it, and then for Colleen can kind of come into that world and play in our sandbox of structure, musical theater structure.
Yeah.
Well, not just musical theater structure. I mean, yes, there's definitely that, but I mean, Stephen King's universe is so vast and so wacky with its own rules, that trying to confine that to a musical stage is very difficult. And so having it's been like almost like a translator, I feel like this is how this works. It's like, okay, cool. Well, this is how it works under the stage. All right.
I have to add, as somebody who's probably, I guess I would put myself in the least of the three of us who know Stephen King, probably, to be fair to both of them. But what cracked me up is that until closing and probably after, I was like, what does that lyric mean? And Mark will be like, it's the name of a book. And I'll be like, it is? Back of Bones?
The Different Seasons lyric, oh my god, and Wendy's song, so fucking good. I loved it so much. Andy, I'm glad that you brought up that structure, because I think that is, to me, as a theater fan, I was a theater kid. I can't sing, so I only did one musical. What I love about this show versus other shows that I've seen that are not, you know, revivals on Broadway, things like that, that are well known, is that some of those lesser known ones feel a little sloppy, and everything about this show feels tight from beginning to end. Everything feels like it has a purpose. Everything moves something forward. If it's not moving something forward, it's because it's paying off a laugh that was built up. It's just that your structure is so solid.
I mean, it's changed even since you've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Man. Does that mean I get to watch another version sometime on the sneak peek? Is that...
Come to 54 Below on May 8th.
Yes. Good plug. You guys actually gave us an idea with your show, because, Colleen, you mentioned the Jack Torrance, Annie Wilkes team up. Mm-hmm. We do a live stream called Dairy Fight Night, where we turn Stephen King characters into pro wrestlers, and we do a pay-per-view event on Twitch and call it like a real match. We've done three of them. They're on our YouTube if you'd like to take a look.
Yes.
But in our next event, I'm now creating a tag team of Annie Wilkes and Jack Torrance.
Well, I mean, they're destined for each other,
because
you have a writer and you have someone who wants to support a writer. They belong together.
Which is great, because seeing that pairing, at first I was, you know, Shining in Misery, obviously I knew these are going to be pivotal characters in there, but the first thing on my mind was, how are they going to bring these things together and make it make sense? And then it wasn't considering that relationship of Annie to writers, that until it happened in the show, and I was like, duh, oh, it's genius.
There's a blizzard, and hey, they're Colorado. I know
we were talking about structure, and I also thought we should give a big shout out to our director, Donald Garbarek, who Mark knew, actually, mm-hmm. and worked with. I did not, and Colleen did not, but boy, he did some amazing things for us, and really sort of was our dramaturg throughout this whole process, and helped steer us in the right direction in a couple of places. So he deserves a huge shout out. And then I also want to mention my orchestrator and musical director, Evan Lang, who took those songs and orchestrated them for that band that you hear, so that they sound creepier and sound like they belong in the world that they are in. So just a couple shout outs to them while we're talking about structure.
Absolutely, man. For those who don't do live production, you know, it takes a village.
And yeah, they're so good. I've known Don for years now and worked with him a few times. And when we talked about who could be a possible director, knowing that Donald's background is, I mean, obviously in musical theater, and he is so good at what he does, but he spent a lot of time working on parody out here. The Office, and a parody of 90210, and so on. And he's just so good at creating a story out of that.
He did like the Pirates of Penzance in space or something.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And he has his own...
Amazing.
He's a writer himself. He has a musical, Show Choir, the musical, that shows that he knows musicals from inside out. Like, it doesn't matter what part he's working on, he knows how they work. And he was just a natural fit for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, the show has so much, like, and even one of the lyrics that's a little kitschy. All of that charm gives me so much Rocky Horror vibes.
Oh, which is like one of my
favorite. It's like one of my favorite shows to watch. you don't have to be somebody who knows everything about King, because there's plenty of other musical references. There's the pop culture references. How was it to walk that line?
We wanted to have definitely as many Easter eggs as possible for the diehard number one fans, of course. With the original production, we wound up with a little over 125 references, and that was scaling back from what we originally wanted to put in, probably more. But at the same time, like you said, the pop culture references, because of all the movie and TV adaptations of his work, even if nobody's picked up a Stephen King book, they know these characters. They know, here's Johnny.
Yep.
They know that stuff. And then these two guys could really riff and parody off the well-known musicals. And a lot of them were surprisingly good fits in a very twisted, fun way.
Mark, what was that? What was the one that it's still one of my favorites that I think you came up with it. You said I was watching that one made for TV movie, and it was the Ear of Corn and the Ear of the Corn.
Sleepwalkers.
Yes.
I wrote down in my notes, I wrote Sleepwalkers reference, underlined it four times.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorites. I have to say that was
a fun moment where you're trying to figure out a good murder sequence, and that popped up, and I'm like, oh, this is delicious. We can use corn. We have corn.
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of it was like the material lends itself to that, but I think something that really helped us was that structure. Going back to that is that like we wanted to make sure that the show was a good show first, and then like make sure it had all the parody and the funny and all the references, but we had to make sure it worked, because there's a lot of parody out there that's just vignettes or it's just, right, you know, joke after joke, but no substance. And for this, we wanted to make sure like, okay, here's a journey. Here's the characters. Here's the real situation and some emotional stakes. And now here's all the funny.
Yeah. Every character feels true to the source material with the leniency of parody, you know, and that's what I thought was really incredible, is seeing these characters. Like I didn't recognize anybody, you know, cool. Especially, I don't know whose idea this was, Trisha McFarland.
I knew you were gonna say
that. Oh my God. Thank you for that. That made me so happy. I can't even tell you.
I'm so happy to know that.
Oh,
a lot of that though, knowing that the characters being true to their sound, that's Colleen. There's a lot of hey, like, because I'm writing and like and sending it over, and then so that's actually not how that character sounds. I'm like, oh, you're right. Let's change and find this. No one knows King like you.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You're the queen of King.
Yeah.
I try. Boy. And of course, our dream is one day, if we could get Stephen King himself in the audience and I could make him laugh, I'll just die a happy woman. That's it. You know, I don't need to do anything else after this.
Hell yeah. I love that. Well, hopefully we'll push this out and he'll see this.
I'm excited and scared. I joke that he knows a thousand ways to kill me. So I hope he likes it.
Right.
A lot of them are eye trauma related, though.
Yeah.
Stephen King loves his eye trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping we've touched about things, and I plan to stay spoiler free, but then I couldn't help myself with things I want to talk about because I love the show. But as spoiler free as possible for people who would see it, what are some moments in the show that each of you are just like really proud of?
Yeah,
this was actually an audience reaction okay. to something a little bit better known. From Shining, when a very sweet grandmotherly type woman had a very audible reaction during one of our matinees and exclaimed, "Oh!" grasping the meaning of reverend for the first time when Danny was pointing it out, and just everybody cracked up. You know, she might have been one of the only people in the audience that didn't know that before, but it was just like this universal sort of, yeah, she gets
rid of. If Joshua saw the video that Mark, that, I think Mark
it
said,
was actually that night.
That was, hear it.
I'm gonna go back and listen.
What was for me, I remember watching that live and just being so, like, it was hysterical, but I was also was horrified because it's a moment that we know, like, we all know, like, Red Rum means murder, like, that's there, and that was the moment where she was just like, oh, but for me, I'm like, there's a reveal about to happen, stop laughing, like, we actually have a plot point.
No, there's a plot coming.
Yeah. Yeah, that was hysterical. I think for mine, it was at the very end of Act One, a character pops up and he's introduced at the last second.
Holy shit.
And I never expected the cheers and applause at that entrance. And yeah, every time there was, and that's what made me jump like just for joy every night, is when he popped up and someone says, like, who the fuck are you? And we all know. It was just, it was such a cool moment.
It's such a out of left field reveal, and yes, I lost my mind. I was so excited.
Cool.
That's probably one of my favorite moments too, even though I had nothing to do with it. mine is, I have to be honest, I'm probably most proud of the Hamilton parody. Like, just for me, musically, just because I was like, oh, that's fun.
Nice.
We won't say that.
Yeah, we can't tell people what it is. People, if you're listening, you need to see this show. It's so good.
I will say, as a lyricist, I'm really proud of that song.
Oh, yeah, man, we're going to talk about the songs here in a minute. I can't wait. Before we get to the music, though, the show has just like a breakneck pace. Lots of every character has their own thing to do. There's people coming in and out. What sort of challenges did you run into early on in the process, whether it be in casting or rehearsal, just trying to keep the flow going?
Trying to figure out, you know, we wanted to keep it at no more than 8 actors, right? And when I was looking at this question and going back in and figuring out, okay, yeah, there's 22 characters if you count Tony as his own puppet who will not be named. Figuring out who is going to play what and how that would work for scene changes, costume changes, transitions.
Yeah. Whoever helped with the quick changes in this show,
those quick changes are
insane.
That's what dressers are for.
Yeah. Yep.
I would say Don helped a lot with that too, because we turned in like the script. And he read it and was like, I love this, but how are you going to do this? Like, who is going to play this character? And you're like, oh, man, I didn't think about that. Or when we finally did narrow it down, he's like, but this person's way over here. How are you going to get them over here? Like, a lot of those logistics fell into it. And he helped us solve those a lot. It was a journey in that sense, too, because we started this in 2019 and did a lot of it during pandemic. And so there wasn't the regular process of let's have a workshop, let's have a bunch of people in a room together and sing through this. There was a lot of Zoom. And even on the trip up to Wisconsin, when I was heading over there, I remember telling my husband, I'm like, I'm so excited. I have seen the material. I'm so stoked, but I'm also terrified. This could go horribly. Like, this is untested. And so I've never been in that position. And I've been so happy with how everything turned out.
Actually, I want to jump in and just mention something about that, which is that, so I'm the artistic director of Capital City Theater here in Madison, which is where we premiered it. So we skipped a bunch of steps that you usually do when you write in a musical. As Mark just said, we skipped the reading process. And the reason that we ended up speeding through it was because there was this brand new festival that was starting in Wisconsin called World Premiere Wisconsin, which is amazing. And it was the first year ever for it. And we were all like asked to be part of it. And we're like, what new show? We got to do a new show. And of course we're like, well, may as well finish it and get on its feet. So there you go. So that's why we skipped those steps. And we were all very frightened. And but what was great was that we had in our budget the money to actually, as you can see from the video, put the show up with real sets and with a real band and professional actors. And it really made a difference.
A Greener Mile has been in my head since I watched it. The swearing triplet during the drive, like, I just when it happened the last time, I like fist pumped. I was so excited. How hard is it to write songs that are funny, catchy, referential, and move the plot forward all at once?
It's a gift.
Yeah. I wish someone would give it to us. No, just kidding.
I think it is hard. It's a puzzle every time, and that's the fun part of it, because when you get it right, it's so wonderful. Of course, there's like, you know, hours of getting it wrong beforehand, but once it lands, it's so much fun. But it is keeping that in mind. You know, what is the character saying at this point? Like, is this the way they talk? Is it giving us enough story? Is the story still moving? And for this one also, I really tried to like look at what Stephen King titles, what Stephen King quotes were available to us. And for that song, I just kept going back, you know, it's, you know, grass is always greener on the other side. And I'm like, well, here is this opportunity to use it, an amazing King title. And it makes sense. And so it worked for that.
Cheery in the midst of all the dreary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have a favorite song? Do any of you have a favorite song from the show?
It alternates. Yeah.
Amazing. Get Busy Living or Get Busy Dying, I think, turned into one that was, a lot of people came up to us afterwards and found it very, like, kind of deeply moving or inspirational. And especially considering we were writing this during the height of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it also made me think, there was something about the show title that I came up with that I thought, yeah, this could be talking about us getting through this collectively, shining in misery. We're all shining and doing our best to shine in misery right now. So yeah, just kind of that inspirational level of getting a little unexpectedly deep in a parody in some ways. It's there.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. It's so funny because musically that song is so simple, and I've never been like, wow, that was really a brilliant writing musically, but it does get stuck in my head too. And then I'm like, you know what? That's a lot of fun, that song. Mm-hmm. So it definitely ranks up there for me. I'm going to stick with my Hamilton parody for my favorite.
Yeah, I alternate with that, and probably the first song that I wrote that we wrote was the Squint Through the Shining.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and just because that was the one that was like, and I wrote a lot of that on a plane trip, and I remember like home and writing this, going, okay, yeah, we can do this, and that was like the turning point for me.
And I don't know why. I Just Haven't Met Her Yet was the song that popped into my head to like use as my model musically for that song. If you listen to it again, Josh, you will hear that if you didn't the first
time. Oh, I'm going to re-listen now.
And then I told Evan, the orchestrator, I was like, this is that song. And he's like, got it. I'll go like literally make it sound like it. So
I didn't know that.
That's outstanding.
So there it is.
Now, how many performances have been done now?
This is the only show, the only production of it.
But how long did it run?
Yeah, just 2 weekends.
Oh, just 2 weekends. What was the audience response like from those shows?
Amazing.
Yeah?
Really?
I mean, I'm not surprised.
It was so funny because our invited dress, Mark will remember this well. Their invited dress, for some reason, they were lackluster. There weren't that many of them. And I drove Mark back to his hotel, and I'm like, Mark, I think we missed. I don't think we hit the bullseye. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And then, of course, the next night it all turned around and everybody loved it.
Yeah.
That's definitely a bit of a roller coaster.
It was. I was a little terrified.
After that. People that were coming back to see it more than once, like the diehards, there was starting to be that thing happening that you were talking about. Like, it's got that potential for a Rocky Horror Picture Show type cult following. And I was noticing a lot of Stephen King t-shirts in the audience and things like that. And apparently people were talking about it out in the nearby parking garages. So figured that was
we're down here in Davenport, Iowa, and when we heard about it, we were like trying to do our damnedest to get up there and make the trip to see it.
You're so close.
I know, right?
Yeah, Davenport's not far.
Like, yeah, we were like, all right, this is like a few hours, we can do this. And then, you know, life happens. And then that's when I was like, well, I'm emailing Mark. I'm emailing somebody because I have to know more.
One thing that was kind of interesting about that too is that I got into a habit of when I would do my pre-show speech of asking the audience, how many of you here are diehard Stephen King fans? How many of you here are like so-so? And then how many of you are musical theater fans? And then we would sort of see where they would cross over. And it was surprising how few diehard fans were in the audience and how there was a lot more in the middle, which I would love to have had more diehards, but it worked.
Yeah, so, it gave them a permission to laugh.
Yeah.
And kind of gave them a heads up of what to expect. So I loved your speech. I remember telling you, like, do that again. Do that every night.
I did. And it helped the musical theater people, because I had a lot of people who do not know Stephen King all say, it was so great. I know nothing about Stephen King, but the people beside me did, you know, and that was one of my favorite reactions to it, because it's like, they still thought it was funny. They still enjoyed the songs. They still enjoyed the story. Knew nothing about the titles.
There was one night where I watched one guy watch the show as opposed to watching the show, because I saw how he was definitely a diehard, but he was getting every single reference and every there's some rapid fire references at the end of Act One, and I watched him get every single one. And afterwards, I was like, "Who are you?" When I spoke to him, I'm like, "You're the person we wrote this for."
I found the target audience. Here he is.
He's right here. He's in an orange shirt. No, it was amazing to watch that happen.
That's got to be magic. Just seeing somebody get every single hit.
It's also, I have to say, on the not the flip side, just a different side, that it's also one of those shows that people really want to drink alcohol before they see. So we definitely, there was Saturday night of the, I think it was the second weekend. So I think it was after you left, Mark. We had some majorly inebriated folk in there for the second act. And there was like someone would walk on stage and say hi, and the audience would go, hi.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
That kind of audience.
Was it bad? I mean, it wasn't bad. It's like,
it was right. It was
that.
Like, stop.
it's that Rocky Horror cusp. Mm-hmm. If it's any more, it's heckling.
You're right.
Yeah.
But here it's accidental participation.
We just need to add a drinking game and we're good.
So I got to see, like, as I've mentioned, I got to see the run at the Capitol. That cast is phenomenal. I was so excited when you announced this next one that you have most of the cast returning. So people in New York, go. What were some of the things that when you finally got these actors cast that they brought to the table for these roles?
I think just an incredible sense of humor and fun. They mm-hmm. really played well together. I think they really respected what each of them brought to the table. And they played off of each other real well. They kept discovering things and having fun. And that red, it came across.
Yeah. Yeah. Dawn gave them permission to play in the room in a nice way. And I think that they were all such good performers that they came up with some of their own funny bits that it wasn't even necessarily written in the script that slayed us on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, stop trying to make steam happen, which will still always be my favorite line in the entire show. And it's,
I love that line.
No, that one was shenanigans. That one's in the script.
No, it is. But the way he did it was
But there's
Barlow channeling his inner mean girl is just great.
The flag always got me.
Yes,
always got me. Yeah, and there's times where Don would reach out, because I know that Colleen, like Andy was there, but Colleen and I weren't there for some of the rehearsal process. And they would reach out and be like, oh, we have a question, or we have this, or here's something we came up with. What do you think? And it was nice to be like, yeah, that's good. Do that. That sounds great.
Nice.
Because it's, you know, we can only do so much without being in the room and seeing how it's working in the physical mode. And so having them have that ability to play was really, really beneficial.
Yeah, it seemed like there was such great chemistry with that cast.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about the low end of the high of coming from Invited Dress to opening night. Take me back to opening night. What was that experience like for all of you?
Terrified. But it was like, then it was dreams come true, but nightmares and dreamscapes. It was, yeah. And for me, after getting through that nerve-wracking opening night, seeing how it all came together. I mean, for me, I just felt like a little kid. I was in glee. I came to every single performance and I just delighted in it. And I would sit in different places in the theater to see the different perspectives and have a blast.
I remember thinking like this, it never gets easier. Like I've opened a few shows and it never gets easier. You're always nervous and terrified beforehand. But it was just wonderful because we also were coming off of that Invited Dress where I was like, all right. And I had friends out there visiting or who live out there. And so they were coming. So I had a little bit of that support from the outside of people seeing it, but it was still that kind of like, anything can happen. I'm so nervous. But upon the first laughs, like I knew, I was like, okay, all right, here, they're in for this. They're in this.
Nice.
Yeah. No, it was great. I mean, that's the thing about opening night is that you're on you're biting your nails the entire time because it's the first performance. And then after it's over, you have that big sort of like sigh of relief. And it's really the next performance where you relax and you go, okay, we know it works. Let's just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Which performance did I see?
You saw the first Sunday.
First Sunday. Okay, cool. Yeah. They were definitely settled in and like feeling it.
We also did a trivia game after that day.
Yeah.
Where Colleen hosted and we brought 3 and 3 on either team and had just a whole trivia game, College Bowl style trivia game. And then they won stuff at the end, but it was the trivia. Do you remember any of the really great trivia questions, Colleen? These people would appreciate it more than anybody.
With the book versus the movie version of things. Like I think one of them had to do with, you know, the fact that I don't remember exactly how the question was phrased, but the fact that in the book, Paul is hobbled by Annie, or no, he's actually, his foot is cut off, mm-hmm. but they hobble him in the movie. And there's some debate about which is actually scarier because she cauterizes his foot with a blowtorch in the book.
Yeah, she does.
I did not want to show that, but there's something effectively creepy about the whole her explaining where hobbling comes from and why she's going to have to do this for his own good, you know, kind of a
thing. And he looks the best.
Mm-hmm.
I also, on the misery side of this, there's a lyric that is it starts a running joke that is so good, and it is the your clothes are you're well hung and dry. the jokes about Paul Sheldon's endowment. Oh my god, so good. That's
yes, that's a number one fan. Definitely.
That's oh man, I was losing it.
Was it Mark? Was it Colleen's? I don't know if it was Colleen's idea or yours to put the stress on in happiness on the fetus.
Happiness.
Oh,
that was Mark.
Yeah,
that was amazing. So we've talked a little bit about some highlights of the show. Is there a part of the show that still makes you laugh when you see it?
I'm a sucker for Hearts in Atlantis just because it's that duet between Jack and Annie, and then Lloyd the bartender with his droll response just cracks me up every time.
The Lloyd reveal. Oh, that's so good too.
Yay.
Go see the show, people.
Yeah. Without giving spoilers away, there is a conversation between Danny and his mom and Wendy in Act 2. That is the big reveal of why they're all there and how they got there and in some ways who they all are. And watching that conversation, I was always just dying, because from Wendy's cigarettes to Danny to talking to both Danny and Tony. Mm-hmm. And, right. And it's not that much of a spoiler, but the fact that the choice was made that Tony, the finger is always the middle finger, as opposed to, and I didn't catch that until like the second or third viewing of the show.
Oh yeah. No.
Oh yeah, it's funny.
That's so good. It took me like halfway through Act One to notice.
I have to say, like, we've already talked about these, but the reveal at the end of Act One, I just sat there and waited for it because it made me so happy. And stopped trying to make Steam happen. I've sat and waited for it every night because it made me laugh so hard. And it's just silly.
It's silly, but it's wonderful, and that's what parodies are about.
I also really did enjoy Pennywise's entrance in the, well, it used to be called You Could Be It. It's not called that anymore. But yeah. But the we can't give that away. But what he's wearing when he comes in.
Well, I always appreciated that.
Pretty funny.
Yeah. Oh, I loved that. So we've dropped the hints for New York folk, and Andy, you mentioned it earlier. Where is the next chance people have the opportunity to see Shining in Misery live?
Well, at 54 Below in New York City, you know, which is the famous cabaret club that's below Studio 54 on, you guessed it, 54th Street. And it's on May 8th at we're in the late slot, so it doesn't start until 9:30, which actually makes sense for us because of the show that we're doing.
Yeah.
And we are hoping to get a mixture of potential producers that might be interested in the show. And also diehards. We would love to have diehards there. So diehard King fans, please come and see the show.
If you're in the New York area, make the trip. I promise you, you will not regret it. I laughed my ass off. So if let's say a fan is listening and they're in, I don't know, Davenport, Iowa, where we have a musical theater and we could put up a show, how would somebody listening to the show who has a place get you there?
That's a really good question. Well, I should also mention that we have a website.
Yep.
Yes. shiningandmisery.com. Anybody, and you can actually see some video of the show. You can read more about us. You can read more about the show, all of that stuff. And we actually have an email that people can actually write us at, that we all see. And it's actually shiningandmisery@gmail.com. That easy. shiningandmisery@gmail.com. And if people have an interest in doing the show, they should write to that email and we will all see it.
Perfect. If you could, would you do a tour?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Help produce it. Yeah. Would not hesitate.
Yeah. And I'll go with it. Just watch it.
That would be the best part, is like when something gets to leave your hands and you get to see it all fresh and new, handled by someone else.
It's I mean, even just from this one, I remember walking into the theater and seeing that giant set and knowing what we were about to see and thinking like, wow, a couple of years ago this was like a paragraph. This is
an idea in the DMs.
Yeah.
And here we are.
It's amazing, though, I think my colleagues can speak to this, too, but it's amazing what deadlines will do for you as a writer. Mm-hmm. Like, it forces you to get stuff done, and honestly, it forces you to write, for me, it forces you to write better stuff, I think.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people, this festival, like, you just have to finish the show in 3 weeks.
I mean, we kind of did. We kind of wrote, like, I don't know, 5 songs in 3 weeks. It was crazy there for a while.
What is what would you say is the average time for writing a song for a musical?
But they're all so different.
Yeah. Like, I think it takes me a few hours to write the wrong song and then an hour to write the right song.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so tricky because, like, I'm sure Mark could speak to this too, but, like, sometimes it comes to me like that and it's super easy, and other times I labor over it. So like there's no average, because sometimes it will take an hour and sometimes it will take many mm-hmm. hours.
if you had to say, what would you say the easiest and most difficult song in this show, like the for the challenge wise of putting it together for you both?
Honestly, Get Busy Living was super easy to write musically, because Colleen said King's favorite band is the what do you call it?
The Ramones. That's Ramones, one of right. my favorite bands.
The Ramones. So I started listening to the Ramones, and I got hung up on what's that thing about the Earth, the last night, or what is it? The song they wrote that's kind of famous.
I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery.
No, it wasn't that one. There was another one that I got really.
That Ramones. Love that song.
That saying, this is what we should have something like this.
Yeah. No, but I listened to some Ramones and I'm like, okay, I get it. And so when I saw the lyric, I was like, I get it. And so it was, that one was super fast because nice. It was like them ish, you know. Hardest song. What did we labor over, Mark? Writing on My Mind, is that one that we
say that?
Because we wrote that twice.
We had to write it twice.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Well, it was that part of it was that Don, our director, was really cleverly trying to get us to parody musicals more than we were.
Yeah.
And that song actually originally was in the first act. Wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
It was in the first act.
And it didn't really parody anything. And so we twisted it and turned it so that it parodied a very specific musical.
Nice. Hell yeah.
And so the whole opening part changed and some stuff in the middle changed. Four of the song kind of stayed the same. Anyway, that one was
hard. Made it fun. Yeah. I think the easiest was probably Squint, because I mean, again, it I knew exactly what it wanted to be for that, and that helped me figure out what the show wanted to be. I think the hardest is the end of Act One, mostly because I was still working on it like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that what that's, though, that speaks to structure too in a way, because the end of an act in musical theater is what when we learn to write shows, what we learn is that the end of the first act has to be the point of no return. So it's the point at which characters reach a point where they can no longer go back, and the audience has to go, oh gosh, what's going to happen next, right? And when you have four people in a conundrum ensemble where they're all in a conundrum about something, that's hard to write. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you're reacting to. At least that's what I was reacting to when I was.
But like I said, this show is nonstop plate spinning. There's no rest for the weary in this show. And
now it's gonna even more like that in the rewrites that are
100%. Especially for poor Wendy, who Madeline, who played, you know, all of those roles so quickly.
Man, is she who had the most costume changes?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh gosh, I played 8 characters, like something like that. It was crazy.
Yeah, what sucks about the costume changes for me is that I want to write all this backup harmony, and I can't because they're all getting their costumes changed. And I only got 2 people on stage, and I got 4-part harmony.
Well, musical theater problems, you know. I hate it. So where can people follow each of you, your careers, and everything Shining in Misery?
Besides the website that Andy pointed out, and tickets are still available for the New York show at the 54below.org website. We also have a Shining in Misery Facebook page and an Indiegogo campaign.
Nice. You have an Instagram also, right?
Yeah, we do.
Yep.
Instagram as well. Yep. So, yes.
And I have to do one like tiny bit of chilling here in the sense that we, the authors, are putting this, like, we are footing the bill for this 54 Below concert. It's just the 3 of us. And so that's why we have made this Indiegogo campaign. So if folks are listening and they want to come see it and they go to our website and they're like, this is amazing, we encourage you to help us bring it to New York City. My website, I have a website, it's andrewabrams.net. You can go there and check out who the heck this guy is talking about music. and I also encourage people to go to capitalcitytheater.org, capital with an A, theater with an RE.org, capitalcitytheater.org, and check out our theater company, and you'll see stuff about Shining in Misery there. And all the other stuff that we're doing, because we're doing a world premiere this fall of another show I'm working on, a new It's a Wonderful Life musical.
Awesome.
So
that's terrific.
Yeah. Mark.
My website is markeugenegarcia.com. On the socials, I can be reached at StorytellerMG. Super easy from all of the socials.
You can find me, Colleen Duvall, on SoundCloud. I have a couple different podcasts I do on there. Also on the Facebook. And I am not related to Shelley Duvall. That is my mom's actual maiden name that I like to use for professional reasons.
But Colleen, you do this awesome podcast called Howl at the Moon. Is that what it's called?
Women Who Howl at the Moon.
Yeah. And so she's into all this stuff. Like,
that's a terrific title. What is that show?
Oh, it's weird and witchy and new agey. And I talk to different women from all over every month. Usually a lot of them have artistic backgrounds. One of my biggest guests, return guests, is Phyllis Curat, who's like one of the best selling Wiccan pagan authors of all time. And she's an activist.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, we're going to go ahead and make sure we get links to the tickets for the show, your Indiegogo. We'll get all that, put that in the show notes. So if you are listening and it is you are able to make it to New York, I encourage you, go see the show. I know I've said it a million times today, but like I was on the floor laughing. I had so much fun with this. Thank all of you for being here, and thank you for being willing to share this piece of art with all of us, with all of us King fans.
Oh, definitely. Pleasure.
So much.
Yeah. That's it for this episode of Dairy Public Radio. As always, thank you for listening. Join us for our next episode. For Colleen Duvall, Mark Eugene Garcia, Andy Abrams, I'm Joshua Kahn, saying thank you and good night.
That's all for now, listeners. Goodbye.